What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is David Hirschberg, author of the new novel, Jacobo's Rainbow. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach, a happy and healthy Passover and Aziz and Pesach. It's the first day of the Festival of Freedom and Matzah, which also makes it the morning after the first Seder, or as some of you may say, the only Seder. For Orthodox and Conservative Jews, there are Seders both last night and tonight, while for many, but not all, Reform Jews, there is only one Seder. In either case, the Seder itself is much more than a meal. It is an extraordinary educational experience on the subject of freedom. On every Seder table, there is a cup filled with wine in the center, usually a large and beautiful vessel just awaiting the arrival of a dramatic figure's visit. At the proper time, after the Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meals, and the third of our four cups of wine, we Jews open the door for Elijah the prophet. We sing Eliyahu HaNavi, among the best known of all Jewish melodies, and we invite this unique figure to join us for a few moments. The text of the Haggadah, the telling of the great tale of freedom and liberation that leads us through this night of Passover, includes a brief passage asking God to punish the enemies of Israel throughout history. And then, after we watch carefully to see if the level of wine in Elijah's cup diminishes, we turn the lights back on and close the door and resume our Seder. It is a peculiar and poignant moment, unique in Jewish tradition. We open the door, and symbolically we await Elijah's arrival. And while young children strain to see the magic of an invisible prophet sipping very real red wine, the mystic quality of the experience can touch even a hardened Seder veteran. Other beautiful traditions have become attached to the Elijah's cup at the Seder. In my own home, we do a memorial at that time for the victims of the Shoah, the Holocaust. And in particular, we remember the incredibly courageous and doomed Warsaw Ghetto Uprising that began on the first night of Passover in 1943, the very night of the first Seder that year. My father's own poem about this reads, "Elijah, lift your hand, appear in power, and in this hallowed hour now prophesy of them. They are not dry bones lying in a veil. The table lengthens and grows wide. They have come in. They sit on every side. Who among us is the living? Who the dead? We, saved by chance, or they? We sit together and wait the oath. Elijah, celebrate a Seder for us both." Others have their own unique ways of inviting in Elijah the prophet and associating Eliyahu with the arrival of the Messiah, a connection first made perhaps 1,800 years ago in the Midrash. Elijah, we are told, will arrive on earth again as a harbinger of the Messiah, a visitor heralding the arrival of a new messianic age. There's a powerful Midrash about Elijah the prophet in the Babylonian Talmud Tractate of Sanhedrin, in which Elijah teaches a great rabbi that the Messiah himself sits at the gates of the city of Rome, bandaging lepers as he awaits the call to bring about the messianic time. There are funny tales of Elijah's arrival too, of course. One of my favorite stories about Passover is a Hollywood story. It comes from Sandy Hackett, who talked about his father, the late great comedian Buddy Hackett, You know, the guy with the marbles in his mouth. Ever since I was a little kid, says Sandy Hackett, I remember Dad having an open house for Passover. Actors, fellow comics, singers, they were all there for the Seders. One thing vividly stands out in my mind. I went to open the door to let Elijah the prophet in, and standing there was Gregory Peck. He asked if it was too late for the service, and I said, "No, go right in. We're all expecting you." I guess if you open the door for Elijah the prophet and Atticus Finch comes in, you're still doing pretty well. And at our own first very successful congregational Seder at my own congregation Beit Simcha, the children present rushed to open the door for Elijah and saw a rattlesnake nestled just outside. Hastily, we closed the door, called some animal handlers to pick up the snake, and instead of Eliyahu HaNavi, we named him Eliyahu HaNachash, Elijah the Snake. But who really was Elijah the prophet, this dramatic figure in Jewish conception? What does the Tanakh, the Bible, say about him in its description of this story and the tales it tells from his own life? Well, in essence, Elijah was a brave, committed believer in the one true God, a kind of miracle worker who spoke truth to power, who stood up courageously to the corrupt leaders of his generation who tried to suppress dissent and cultivated falsehood. Elijah represented truth and morality. He fought against the popularity of false ideas and of vindictive and powerful rulers, and triumphed at the very end by the narrowest of margins. And Elijah came to represent to Jews for all time that fervent belief, moral conviction, and faith in the God of Israel can carry us through the darkest of times. It is perhaps no mystery why Elijah became such a treasured figure in Jewish life. Elijah's present by tradition at every single Brit Milah, every bris of an eight-day-old boy who is circumcised, and a kisei shel Eliyahu, a chair of Elijah, is set aside for him, usually with a pillow for his comfort. Elijah's present at the end of every Shabbat when we sing Eliyahu Hanavi et Havdalah, the conclusion of the Sabbath, a mystical beginning of a week that we pray will bring joy and peace and just maybe the Messiah. And of course, Elijah comes to every Seder, reminding us that even when freedom may seem like a distant hope, still its promise is ever present, and we need to work to secure it for ourselves, for our children, and for our entire world. Of course, Pesach is not all Elijah, and it's certainly not all seriousness. To play us in on this first day of Passover, here's the a cappella group 613 with a truly amazing interpretation of Pesach, the Red Sea Shanty, a pirate Passover. I kid you not, though they are kind of kidding. But shtick done this well deserves to be heard.
There once was a time in Egypt land, the Jews were slaves in the desert sand. We cried out for an outstretched hand, oh, let my people go.
Soon may our freedom come to bring us liberty, peace, and fun. One day when the Pharaoh's outdone, he'll let my people go.
Brave Moses with his shepherd's rod had heard the mighty voice of God. It said, tell Pharaoh clear and strong to let my people go.
Soon may our freedom come to bring us liberty, peace, and fun. One day when the Pharaoh's outdone, he'll let my people go. Oh, what shall we do with the middle matzah? What shall we do with the middle matzah? What shall we do with the middle matzah? Erlai in the Seder.
Hide it away is the Afikoman. Hide it away is the Afikoman. Hide it away is the Afikoman.
Erlai in the Seder. Oy vey, let's get some prizes. Oy vey, let's get some prizes. Oy vey, let's get some prizes. Later in the Seder. Soon may our freedom come to bring us liberty, peace, and fun. One day when the Pharaoh's outdone, he'll let my people go.
Now Pharaoh's heart was not appeased. No Hebrew slave shall ever go free. But Moses said, let's wait and see. The plagues began to grow.
Oy! Soon may our freedom come to bring us liberty, peace, and fun. One day when the Pharaoh's outdone, he'll let my people go.
Just lean to the left and we'll tell the tale of how we left Egypt. God split the sea and we walked across with no need for a ship.
But first, before we get to that, there's sons and questions for. Just when you think it's almost done, there's 3 hours more.
There's 3 hours more.
For Pharaoh sent men after us, their lives would soon be lost. And we spill wine drops from our cups, cause freedom had a cost.
Cause freedom had a cost.
So every year we celebrate our freedom with a smile.
With Moses and Ramses too. Asked by the youngest one, we'll sing and have some fun for wonders long ago.
Egyptian firstborn sons were lost. The sea of reeds we firmly crossed. They followed, but was at great cost.
They all were dragged below. Hey, lads, the Seder is done. We told our tale of redemption. The Shana Haba Abi Yerushalayim.
That was the Red Sea Shanty by 613, a pirate Passover for Pesach's first day this morning. When we return on To Jewish in a Moment, our guest, David Hirschberg, whose second novel, Jacobo's Rainbow, was just released, will join us and explain how he has captured the 1960s and the Vietnam War era in a remarkable and very Jewish way. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina Foothill, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone during normal times. In these, well, hopefully fading days of coronavirus Tsoros, a group can join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning, or even this morning for Passover services at 10 o'clock, by emailing me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org. You can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. We continue to hold services with full music by virtual experience weekly, as well as our growing in-person masked and careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access those by emailing us at beitsimchatucson.org, but many of those classes and our wonderful religious school are available in blended formats too, some live, some on Zoom. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to meet us in person and to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook, go to beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, beitsimchatucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. David Hirschberg is the author of his second novel, Jacobo's Rainbow, a really fascinating and intricate novel. I should let you know that David Hirschberg is the official pseudonym for an entrepreneur, a very successful one, who prefers to keep his business separate from his writing. His first novel was My Mother's Son, and he welcomed back to Two Jewish. Good morning, David.
Thank you very much. It's a thrill to be here, and I appreciate your having me back again.
So, fascinating setting for this Jewish novel. Tell us a little bit about how that evolved.
So I was looking for a time and a place to actually be a mirror, to reflect what's going on today in America. And I felt that if I was going to actually talk about today in America, I wrote a book in a setting that was known to everybody with characters who were in the news, that the people on the left would say I'm on the right, the people on the right would say I'm on the left, and there'd be a great debate about, you know, where I am, and the whole gist of the novel would be lost. So I looked for a place back in time where I could find some events that made sense, which kind of mirrored what was going on today. And I found the time in the mid-1960s. And I went back to the era of the free speech movement, the Freedom Summer, when busloads of young people were going down south to register blacks. Most of us remember the horrible deaths of Andrew Goodman and James Cheney and Michael Schwermer, and also the Vietnam War. All the activities, the mass protests, burning of draft cards, and the hell no, we won't go chants. And I found that if I had created this in UC Berkeley, which is where the free speech movement started, then people would pick apart and say, well, I was there and this didn't happen then, and your sequence is wrong. So I did no research on that, and I created a fictitious university in New Mexico. New Mexico allowed...
University of Taos, I have to say.
Of Taos, yeah, exactly right. And it allowed me to do several things. One is not only to have Jewish characters, and I have Ashkenazi, Sephardim, and Mizrahi Jews, but also bring in Native Americans and the land and the Rio Grande River, which all play an important part of the book. And the setting just seemed right. And as I started to write it, I said, this is correct, and I made the right decision not to do anything anyplace else. But I have to say, when I told my wife I was doing this in New Mexico, she looked at me like I was crazy. She said, Jews in New Mexico? But I said, read it first, and then tell me afterwards what you think. So that's how I started, and that's where it ended up.
By the way, I was a scholar in residence in Santa Fe. There are synagogues in New Mexico, but not a lot of Jews in Taos. It's a fascinating book. We'll continue this great discussion with David Hirschberg about his book, Jacobo's Rainbow, and we return in a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And by the way, Chag Sameach, happy Passover. One of the interesting aspects of Jewish history, and one reason Jews are in so many different places, we're considered wandering Jews. It goes back to Pesach, maybe before that. My father was a wandering Aramean. But one of the reasons Jews had to keep moving after the destruction of the Second Temple, and even before that, was they would move into an area, become accepted, use the many skills they brought with them to become successful, and then eventually there'd be persecutions and expulsions. There's debate as to why that happens so frequently. When I teach a very broad class on Jewish history, I'll describe this as kind of a sequence of processes where Jews move in, are considered helpful, then they become too successful, then their neighbors become jealous, or the rulers become concerned that they're too powerful, and they are then stripped of possessions and expelled. That's one kind of microcosm of Jewish history, maybe best exemplified by people like the Prime Minister of Israel's father, Netanyahu, who had a whole series of excellent books basically advancing this theory. Tell me, that's not the only way of thinking about it.
Right, although it is a prevalent way of thinking about Jewish history. And just today I got an email from a former student who's living and working in Kazakhstan, who finally made time to listen to my podcast series. And he listened to the very first episode on Thessaloniki, and he learned about Spanish-speaking Jews there who were there as a result of the mass expulsion from Spain in 1492. So he asked me, isn't it the case that Jews throughout history, when they have found themselves in a situation where they were allowed to prosper, instead of being frivolous with their money and ostentatious, they husbanded it carefully and grew prosperous and contributed to the prosperity of their host community. But eventually, when too many Jews got too wealthy, their non-Jewish neighbors, whether Muslims or Christians, were jealous and either killed them or expelled them. And that was this non-Jewish guy's view of Jewish history. And I think it's one that's, although clearly an oversimplification, it's one that's shared by many Jews. But I don't think it's correct. First of all, there are places where Jews were never expelled, or they were expelled one time for 4 years or something, you know, some momentary blip on the radar screen. There were also places where Jews never really became prosperous. But in the case of Spain, particularly in the south of Spain, in Andalusia, Jews were not only prosperous, but also very prominent in the arts, philosophy, sciences, medicine, et cetera, et cetera. They were...
Even the military, actually.
The backbone of the Islamic kingdom there. And the expulsion from Spain happened for many reasons, but it's probably not because of jealousy about the material wealth of the Jewish community. And I want to come back to this next week and look at other reasons that explain the expulsion.
Okay, we will return and continue. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish, as a public service just for Pesach. During a trip to London, I became friends with a very wealthy but very modest Jewish chap named Hyman Goldfarb. Hyman told me that his large donations to British charities through the years led the Queen to wish to knight him at the next birthday honors, but he was going to have to turn it down. "That's a great honor for a Brit," I said. "Why would you turn it down?" "Because during the ceremony you must say something in Latin," he said, "and I don't know any Latin." "Well, say something in Hebrew," I recommended. "The Queen won't know the difference." "Brilliant," Hyman exclaimed. "But what should I say?" "Well, what about the question the children asked the father on the first night of Pesach? Can you say that in Hebrew?" "Oh, of course," Hyman said. "Manishtana halayla hazeh." Thank you, old sport. I shall become a knight. At the ceremony, Hyman waited his turn patiently while several of the other honorees went before the queen, had the sword put on their shoulders, spoke Latin, and were knighted. Finally, they called, "Hyman Goldfarb, please approach your sovereign." Hyman knelt before Queen Elizabeth. She placed her sword on one shoulder and then the other, and motioned for Hyman to speak. Out came, "Manishtana halayla hazeh." The queen turned to her aide and said, "Why is this knight different from all other knights?" Ah, that was a classic old Jewish joke of the week special, a feature of Two Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well and enjoy this night too. And now a word of Torah. The Torah readings on Pesach, on Passover, are some of the most dramatic and interesting of the whole year. We recall the Exodus from Egypt in a variety of ways, in prose, in poetry, and by recalling the sacrifices of our ancestors and the rituals that we still observe. We use Torah during Passover in the same way we use the Haggadah at the Seder, to teach, remind, and refresh our understanding of the great blessing and value of freedom and liberty in every possible permutation. Freedom is so easy to take for granted. We must always remind ourselves of its blessings. And we do so by celebrating freedom in word and song. May we always enjoy the liberty to do so in this society and in every society. And may others who are not yet free become free soon. On this Sunday of Pesach, and in tribute to the bread of very little flavor, here's the wonderful poet Marge Piercy, a multiple past guest of Two Jewish, her positive spin on matzah. "Flat you are as a doormat and as homely, no crust, no glaze, you lack a cosmetic glow. You break with a snap. You're dry as a twig split from an oak in midwinter. You're bumpy as a mud basin in a drought. Square as a slab of pavement, you have no inside to hide raisins or seeds. You are pale as the full moon pocked with craters. What we see is what we get. Honest, plain, dry, shining with nostalgia, as if baked with light instead of heat. The bread of flight and haste in the mouth you promise, home." The poem Matzah by Marge Piercy for Pesach, whose first day is today, with a week of matzah still to come. Yum, yum. When we return on Two Jewish, our guest, David Hirschberg, tells us why he located his Jewish protagonist of Jacobo's Rainbow in New Mexico, of all places. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Ah, yes, Israel held a national election again last week, its fourth in like 2 years.
It's Groundhog Day!
Groundhog time.
Don't stop me if you've heard this before. In a hotly contested election that will decide the fate of longtime Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and the soul of the nation...
Time.
Nothing was decided except that there is no clear consensus or majority in Israel yet again. Netanyahu probably can't assemble a right-wing coalition of over 60 seats in the 120-seat Knesset, while the center-left coalition behind Yair Lapid is unlikely to get over 55 seats in any reasonable configuration. Since the so-called National Unity Government cobbled together last time between Netanyahu and then-leader of the center-left, Benny Gantz, proved to be yet another Netanyahu's sleight of hand, No sane politician on the center or left will enter a coalition with Bibi, which means that after a caretaker government under, you guessed it, Bibi Netanyahu, well, after that is formed, there will be...
Time.
Another Israeli election, and I'd put money on it again coming out a painful, expensive draw. You know, if the United States often seems now like it doesn't have enough democracy, Israel may just have too much. The end result may be that yet again, Bibi Netanyahu's trials for corruption get pushed even further down the line. We'll see. Sigh, ay vey. You only thought it was Passover this week. It's actually...
It's Groundhog Day!
Groundhog time.
Yep, like Bill Murray in that long-ago movie, stuck in an eternal time loop, it's actually Groundhog Day in Israel. In news of much older vintage, but somehow more fresh and novel... A new set of Dead Sea Scrolls, ancient fragments of biblical texts dating back almost 2,000 years and hidden during the final Jewish revolt against Rome, have been found in caves over the Dead Sea. The Israel Antiquities Authority announced a four-year archaeological project uncovered portions of the Book of 12 Minor Prophets, the Treasar, including the books of Zechariah and Nahum. It was the first such discovery of a new scroll in 60 years. Also uncovered was a 6,000-year-old skeleton of a partially mummified child and a 10,500-year-old basket. Israeli authorities say that may be the oldest one in the history of the world. A CAT scan revealed that the child's age was between 6 and 12. Skin, tendons, and hair partially preserved. Wild. Among the recovered texts, all written in Greek, is Nahum chapter 1, 5 to 6, which says, "The mountains quake because of God, and the hills melt. The earth heaves before God, the world and all that dwell therein. Who can stand before God's wrath? Who can resist God's fury? God's anger pours out like fire, and rocks are shattered because of him." The Israeli Antiquities Authority says these words differ slightly from other versions, shedding a rare light on how biblical text has changed over time. The first set of Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, were discovered by a Bedouin shepherd in 1947 and are among the most important archaeological finds of the 20th century or any century. Most of those scrolls are in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Qumran, the site where they were first found, is located in land that became part of Israel in the Six-Day War of 1967. It's very exciting to see these finds and expose them to the public, finds which shed a great light on our history, said Avi Cohen, CEO of the Ministry of Jerusalem and Heritage. These finds are not just important to our own cultural heritage, but to the whole world. Other items include a cache of coins bearing Jewish symbols, including a harp and a date palm, arrowheads and spearheads, fabric, sandals, and lice combs, all dating from the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt, 132 to about 136, in which Jews fought against Roman rule in Judea and lost. The treasures were found in what the Antiquities Authority called the Cave of Horror in the Judean desert, discovered in 2017. The area's unique dry climate means documents found there have survived in unusually good condition. Using methods more typically seen in a Hollywood movie than an archaeological project, researchers rappelled down a precarious cliff face to reach the cave opening, 262 feet below a cliff and flanked by gorges on either side. Drones were used to survey even harder-to-reach parts of caves. The authority pointed out that accessing the cave is forbidden on safety grounds. The remarkable discoveries were made during an Israeli project to prevent looting in Eretz Yisrael, which experts say has been a constant threat to undiscovered artifacts ever since the first discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Antiquities Authority Director Israel Hassan, who launched the operation, urged the Israeli government to do more to protect other undiscovered treasures. And finally, George Segal, whose long acting career included playing Albert Pops Solomon on The Goldbergs and receiving an Oscar nomination for supporting actor for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, died last week at the age of 87. You know, for a while there, in the late 60s and early 70s, George Segal seemed to be in every single movie, or at least the few that Gene Hackman wasn't in. He was perhaps best known for films like A Touch of Class, King Rat, and Where's Papa? But I think I liked him best in the TV sitcom Just Shoot Me, in which he played a clueless boss. He always seemed very Jewish for a leading man, which of course he was. If by that you mean a Jewish guy who sounded like he was from Great Neck, which he was, unlike, say, William Shatner, who turned 90 last week and is still with us, but never seemed Jewish, although he is. Anyway, that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. David Hirschberg is the author of the really wonderful new novel, Jacobo's Rainbow, which explores the 60s in a unique and, I think, very special way from the perspective of a Jew from a tiny community that's not even officially recognized. This is his second novel. It follows the success of My Mother's Son. He's also published a couple of short stories. David Hirschberg has an undergraduate degree from Dartmouth, a master's from Penn, very successful business career, and lives in Westchester County, New York, which is a very long way from New Mexico. In exploring the 60s, you have a guy who start the book with, I think I'm giving away too much here, the anniversary of his being arrested for protesting the Vietnam War, and then... a lot of things happened. Tell us a little bit more about how it evolves.
So what I did was I set the tone by having a student protest at the university. And it pirouettes around a leading character who you think is a terrific young man. And the way so many things are in the book, there are misdirections and feints, and you find out along the way that he's not exactly who he appears to be. And as the young man whose name is Jacobo Toledano, as he goes through life as a young age, people think he's Spanish, they think he's Italian, they're not quite sure who he is, he doesn't reveal very much about himself, and he meets some characters who he's astounded by because they're so different, because he came from this secluded community that really had very little interaction with others. And it's the process that he goes through in meeting different people and becoming entrapped in a series of events that get out of control. And as a result of that, he starts to mature and to have insights into people and to see things that he hadn't really thought about before because he was really kind of naive and took people at face value. One thing leads to another. And he is accused of theft, which I don't want to get into because it's an unusual kind of a theft. And he's pursued by the police with his best friend. They take an unusual trip down the Rio Grande. And he is eventually found and put in jail. And it's when he's in jail that he finally realizes what really went on in the last few months and how he has changed, and he wants to start to write about it. And that's really the start of the process by which he goes through and then comes out of. But there are many, many twists and turns, and so it's I wish I could say more, but I don't want to give away too much about what's actually happening. But there are lively characters of all different races, stripes, and unusual behaviors, and so I think it all works. The reviewers so far tell me it does.
You know, usually when you're reading a novel of the 60s, you get one side of it. You're hearing people, somebody is a character or the main character, the protagonist, is a war protester, or the protagonist is a Vietnam vet. You don't usually kind of combine those features, if you will. Tell us a little bit about trying to manage that.
So it's that you've actually picked up on something which I think is one of the most important parts of the book, that people are multifaceted. And I have all of the characters that you, when you meet them, you think one thing. And as you learn more about them, you find other things associated with them. And then people's reaction to them changes over time. So what you have is an unusual situation where, for example, Jacobo, who you think is this perfectly innocent, wonderful, naive young man, he makes a major error in his life. He does something which is just not right. And it takes him a long time to be able to come to grips with that. And it's the same thing about the Vietnam War. I have a whole chapter on Vietnam, which I have to tell you in a small tangent. I sent a review copy to somebody who was a physician in Vietnam. And when Jacobo goes to Vietnam, he's a medic. And this fellow called me up, and he said, I know we're the same age, and so I know you were probably drafted in the mid-60s. I didn't know you were in Vietnam. And I said, I never was. Oh. And he said, no, come on. He said, because I was there, and I did what everybody saw, and you wrote about it. And he said, I couldn't have written it better, which is a very nice compliment. I was very pleased.
That's
with
a
that.
Great compliment. That's really powerful. Because people that were there, you know, that's something, that's amazing. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. But what happens is, even Jacobo has mixed feelings. It's not all against the war. He makes some very important comments on the way there and when he's there. And he says, look, at one point in time, and I'm paraphrasing, he says, look, you know, we all know that this is probably not the right thing to do, but we're here and I have a job to do and I want to save my buddies' lives. And so he comes away with a little different perspective. It's not that he is in favor of the war, but you see the maturity and the subtlety and all of the characters. This is what happens to some in a good way and some in a bad way. Some go off the cliff from being what you think are high and mighty. That was the most difficult part of the book for me to write, is to make sure that these characters are true to what you and I are. We're flawed. We're not perfect characters. We're not unidimensional. And I wanted to make sure that these characters could see that. And I had a wonderful editor who was terrific at kicking me in the keister every time I went off a little bit and said, no, you can't do this. That paragraph may be well written, but that character would not say that or do that at this point in his life. It's also very important, I should say, to have a really good editor and to be able to take the criticism, enjoy it, and change things.
Enjoy it. All right, I want you to talk about that. Enjoy the criticism, David. Tell us about enjoying the criticism of your work. That's a little bit like hearing people criticize your children, isn't it?
Well, not quite. I think I'd have a different attitude towards my kids. But I enjoy it because my view is I want this book and all the books I've written, and I've actually written a third one's coming out in about a year and a half.
Terrific.
I want them to be terrific. And so I want somebody to say, no, that's not right. Do something else. And I do enjoy it because if I didn't have that kind of constructive criticism, and I think the word constructive is right, I've had an editor who just said, that's terrible, I don't like it, that wouldn't be good. But I enjoy it when an editor says, think about this from the following point of view. Why would that character do that at this point in time? And I said, wow, I hadn't thought about that. That's a terrific comment, and I take it to heart. So I do enjoy it because I want the best book possible.
What was the most challenging thing about writing Jacobo's Rainbow?
I think that the intersection of three different kinds of Jews was difficult because each one has a different history and brings different things to the fore. The two main characters are two different stripes, and there's another character who's not quite a main character, but she comes from a different background. And I'm not talking about reform versus conservative versus orthodox. It's really the area, the demography of where these people come from. And making sure that each of them is true to that. I happen to be Ashkenazic, and so I had to make sure that I didn't populate the conversations and the approaches to life of people who are Sephardic or Mizrahi in a way that the Ashkenazi speak and act. That wouldn't be authentic. And so that was difficult to do, and I spent a lot of time writing and rewriting to make sure that these characters would be true to the traditions.
In creating characters, do you draw heavily on people you know? Do you try to avoid doing that?
That's a really good question. I don't do that, and nothing in my books is autobiographical. Not a word, not a thought, not an event. So I try not to do the research. As a matter of fact, going back to the question of Vietnam, the fellow said to me, well, what research did you do? And I said, I didn't do any. Because if I looked at somebody's diaries or somebody's memos or somebody's notes or a chapter from a nonfiction book, I might subconsciously borrow something. I'm not suggesting plagiarize, but concepts and thoughts, and I didn't want to do that. So I make up everything out of whole cloth. And that's why I have to write and rewrite and have a good editor to make sure that it does hang together.
What do you enjoy most about writing novels?
Finishing them. Because I have to tell you that the hardest part is starting them. And I can't start until I have an opening sentence or an opening paragraph. And if you don't mind, I'd love to just remind the audience from 3 years ago when you interviewed me, there's a one-sentence opening from my mother's son. It's, when you're a kid, they don't always tell you the truth.
Yeah, it's great.
And from that, people said, oh, my God, there's going to be a lot of mystery here. I'd like you to read, it's a very short paragraph of the opening of Jacobo's Rainbow. It seems as if anniversaries have a way of letting spirits loose. And they don't respect boundaries any more than viruses do. So the only way to fool yourself into thinking you can control them is to make others believe that they can see them as well. A conjurer uses sleights of hand, feints, and misdirections, which can succeed because you're willing to suspend visual disbelief. However, an author only has one dimension to work with, as well as a disconnected audience, which can be a disadvantage. But on the other hand, there's no one to say that what you're reading is false. Today marks the 15th anniversary of a momentous event in my life, the day I was sent to jail. It's the obvious time for me to now tell my story. My guess is that you're going to believe this is fiction. That would be a delusion. And so what I tried to do there is to set the book up to say, gee, if I'm a reader, is what he's saying truthful, not truthful? Is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? And although I had ideas and concept of what I wanted to say about the book, about the student protests, etc., I couldn't start it until I wrote that paragraph. Because that set the framework for me to say, okay, I can go in different directions, and I have the liberty to do so. But what I really want to do is paint the picture of the 1960s, but have people read it as the 2010s, and to say, oh my God, all those things that went on then, we think what's going on now is so unique and different. No, it may not have been mirrored 100%, but oh, it was there, and there's actually been not that much difference. The anecdotes are different. The people are different. The events are different, but the concepts are really the same. And the kinds of things that are going on college campuses today with regard, for example, to free speech and the shutting down of free speech and the cancel culture. Well, if you go back to the 60s, when we had the free speech movement, the idea there was, you know, free speech is free speech. You should be able to say anything at any time. It turns out that was only if you're towing a certain party line.
Yeah,
we didn't realize it at the time, and now we're kind of realizing it. So these antecedents are actually very important, and I want people to, yes, to have fun reading a book about 50 or 60 years ago, but to have them come away and say, yeah, this is a lot about today as well.
You know, it's hard to be in the middle these days, isn't it?
Very hard. I find out that when I have conversations with people who I know are on one side versus the other, I have to be very careful that I don't want to be doctrinaire in what I say. And my late brother-in-law had a 180-degree political view different from mine. And yet, he was the best man at my wedding and probably my best friend for 50 years. And we reached an accommodation very, very early on in our relationship when we were in our 20s, that we had different views on things, but we wanted to listen to the other. And then to say, you know, I hadn't thought about it that way. And people used to marvel at how he and I could be so close because our politics were so different. And yet we voted for different people. But when we talked about a lot of the issues, the strange thing was, we were not that far apart. I find this unusual today. He's an anomaly. Most people, I find, are doctrinaire on one side or the other, and it's very difficult to break through, no matter how much of an olive branch you put
you
out.
Hold out, yeah.
It's really hard.
I want to thank David Hirschberg for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Jacobo's Rainbow. It's a great read as well as fascinating. And pretty darn Jewish. I wouldn't say it's too Jewish, but plenty Jewish. Tell us where people can go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book.
So DavidHirschberg.com, Hirschberg with an I, not with an E. The David, by the way, is from my father-in-law, and the Hirschberg is from my maternal grandfather, the two men who had the most important influence on my life. DavidHirschberg.com, you can read. You mentioned my short stories. They're all there, as well as the two books that I have written and a synopsis of the third book, which is coming out next year, and to buy it on Amazon. And I will tell you that I priced the book appropriately. Most literary fiction now is going between $23 and $28, and I priced it at $19.95. And the
such a deal. Yeah, such a deal.
Well, I during this period of time where people are struggling, I thought it was the right thing to do.
It is indeed. Thank you so much, David. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be New York Times bestselling thriller author Joel C. Rosenberg, whose new book is The Beirut Protocol. Our playout this morning comes from the Maccabees. Apparently, we have a taste for a cappella groups this first morning of Passover. It's their version of Nirtzach, the conclusion of the Seder, including a plethora of songs after you finish the Seder. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach, a happy and healthy holiday of Passover, a kosher and zisen Pesach, and of course a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Chasal Sidur Pesach Keil Chaso Kechol Mishpato Bechukaso Kasher Zachinu Lesader Oso Ken Nizke Laso So Ken Nizke Laso So Shalaim, Meshana Haba, Yerushalayim.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.